And as I mentioned today, instead of listening to a recovery story, we're going to have a conversation. During the call, I am opening it up for anyone to participate. So if you have a question or comment and would like to share, please feel free to press 5-star on your phone. Please say your first name and where you're calling from when you are selected. Thanks. Our guest today is the author of the best-selling book, The Greatest Networker in the World, with over 1 million copies in print around the world. He founded Upline and Network Marketing Lifestyle Magazines, was contributing editor for Success Magazine, founding editor-in-chief for Networking Times, and was one of the founders of the networkmarketingmagazine.com. He is one of the most sought-after speakers and consultants in the booming network marketing industry. Prior to his involvement in network marketing, he lived in the Boston macrobiotic community, studied macrobiotics, and worked as a marketing director for Erewhon Natural Foods, the pioneering natural food company founded and owned by my parents and macrobiotic leaders, Michio and Aveline Kushi. He has since applied what he learned from macrobiotics and many other teachings into the field of network marketing. It is my great, great pleasure to welcome my friend, Mr. John Milton Fogg. Hi, John. Welcome. And let's begin by filling in a bit more of the background. Like, for example, way back then, like, first, what got you into macrobiotics, into the Boston community? And then where did you go from there? How did you get involved into network marketing?
See, you're younger than I am, so you don't have to stretch that far back.
Well, I remember when I was in high school when you were living with us.
I couldn't, for the life of me, if you asked me, like in a court of law, how old you were when I met you, I couldn't tell you. I graduated from the Philadelphia College of Art in 1969, interesting time in America for sure, and not long after I got out of college and I was on my own, I just started to get kind of crazy with food, and I mean crazy. My diet for a number of months, I remember, was dry roasted peanuts, pepperoni, provolone, and muesli cereal. I did that for months. And I worked in a photography studio. My degree is in photography, a Bachelor of Fine Arts, Philadelphia College of Art. And a cousin of the owner of the photo studio where I worked was hanging out with a crazy man and a guy who had worked on the North Slope in Alaska doing that kind of work 3 weeks and get 4 weeks off and make a fortune, and just a real remarkable character, a former Marine drill instructor. And she was hanging out with him and kind of living with him, and they invited me for dinner one night, and he had a 50-gallon garbage pail, galvanized garbage can on his porch, and this was in January, of brown rice, and he made brown rice and some chapatis and vegetables, and I was just enamored of it. And I just picked his brain and picked his brain and picked his brain all about it. In a matter of weeks, I had moved into a study house, which was at that time run by Denny and Tia Waxman on Wingahocking Heights in Germantown, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia.
Wow.
And most of the people in the study house were involved with the store in South Philly called Essene.
Yes.
And Denny was the teacher and the kind of he ran the house. Tia cooked, and I tell you, it was the strangest place I'd ever been in my life. The guys, most of the guys were all kinds of shades of some version of samurai, you know, American samurai, and you know, they would sleep. Some of them even slept on the floor without a futon, and you know, did crazy things. I mean, miso eating contests.
Oh my God!
And how many umeboshi plums could you eat? Doing moxibustion with cigarettes because they didn't have any needles or moxa.
Right.
Just insane stuff. And we would travel. We would take the train or the bus up to Manhattan and sit through 6 hours of Inigaka's Samurai trilogy with our rice balls and our chopsticks and pickles and stuff like that. It was just an extraordinary time. I remember the first day that I walked in, there was this tall, gorgeous woman ironing, and she had one of these long, like 8-inch black, dark brown cigarettes and this long, long black hair. And her name was Tish, and we talked, and Tia, who had to review anybody who came into the study house, you know, you kind of had to pass her interview.
Right.
She wasn't there yet. She was not there, and so I talked with this woman who had a little baby who was very huge and chubby and active. The more I spoke to her, she had a fascinating history. She was a high-level groupie. She had a picture and a bunch of letters wrapped on her bureau, or actually she pulled them out of her bureau and showed them to me, from Paul McCartney.
Oh, my.
And she hung out with the Rolling Stones. The Backstreet Girl song was written about her, and she named the song Paint It Black.
Oh, my.
Your red door and I want it. She came up with the name of that song. So I just thought, you know, macrobiotics was a blast, you know. And I stayed in Philadelphia for some period of time. I left when I was 26, so I was there for a while at that study house. And, you know, we did what you did in study houses back then. I don't know what you do today. I don't know if they exist today.
I don't. Not that I know of. Maybe here and there, but.
But it was, you know, it was a time when communes were not all that unusual.
Right.
But they were always based on something, if it wasn't a farm or something like that.
Now, were you doing any drugs at the time?
No.
No.
Mm-mm.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, other than coffee and beer and
right.
cigarettes, which
right.
which flowed voraciously throughout.
Okay.
Not so much at the house. That was kind of frowned on by Tia.
Uh-huh.
Although you could at 1:30 in the morning come downstairs and see Tia propped in a corner of the kitchen on her third rolling rock. That happened. binging was an art form.
Uh-huh.
And I was searching just now for the name of the restaurant, the favorite restaurant downtown on Market Street in Philadelphia. But it was beer and sandwiches and French fries and stuff like that. And I had visited Boston a couple of times.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you one story that may embarrass you. It embarrasses me. This was when your mom and dad lived on whatever the main street in Brookline is that goes all the way out of town. It was a big white house. Very busy street.
Route 9, Boylston Street.
Boylston Street, right.
Huh.
I remember going to that house for an event, and the event always, of course, had to do, there was food.
Right.
And I believe, and there was a lecture in food.
Yes.
And so I'm milling around in the house, shoes off in my stocking feet, and I start to go upstairs just as for an exploration, and there is this demure Japanese woman in front of me with hair down below her bottom and a very shapely bottom. And I remember walking up the stairs and thinking, and I was one of those young American macrobiotics whose dream in life was to marry a Japanese woman.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that was the apex. That was the top. And so here I am, you know, watching these pretty hips and rear end kind of sashay up the stairs with this gorgeous, glistening black hair, and came around the corner of the steps, and it was your mom. I must have, turned 94 shades of red. She was very polite. She bowed to me, of course. And eventually I ended up living at Buckminster Road for a period of time. I worked for, kind of created a position for myself of director of public relations. Michio gave me that title. I didn't know what the H it meant.
Right.
But I kind of wrote stuff and tried to get the... It was all such a fledgling effort back then, Fia.
Right.
And I ended up eventually working at Air One. Started in the shipping department.
Uh-huh.
And I would describe myself either as the second tier or the third tier of the younger students. I mean, there were people like your father and Herman Ihara and Michelle Abbasara. I think of those people. They were always, those people were direct students of George Osawa.
Right.
And then there were people who came along, Paul Hawken,
yes.
Ty Smith.
Yes.
Jimmy Silver, Bill Tara, Lenny Jacobs, they ran the magazines, the bookstores, the Red Wing bookstores, stuff like that. So that was the era of the macrobiotics when I started in Boston.
Yeah.
I worked for your father for a while, lived in the house, which is where I met you.
Yes.
And that was quite the place, boy. That was, you know. And there were all these study houses around. Bruce Gardner had one, and had just Ken Burns, Jack Garvey.
Right.
Names that some of the people listening might know or might remember.
Right.
And it would take me a while to reconstruct what years this was.
Yeah. That would be early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, yeah.
No, it would be the 70s for sure, not the 60s.
Okay.
I worked for Air One. I started in the shipping department. I worked my way up and ended up with some title. There was a phrase... and I'm not going to remember it, being promoted beyond your ability. And there was a phrase for that in management circles at the time.
Uh-huh.
And at Air One, I was promoted beyond my ability to, the director of operations.
Oh.
Jeff Flasher was at that time the president. He had just taken over from Ty Smith.
Okay.
And I really botched the job. I alienated all of the department heads who worked in the various departments with my arrogance and, you know,
right,
just stupidity.
Yeah.
And I became and Michio created a title for me that was about a mile and a half long, you know, special assistant to the president in charge of nyet, 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 and projects, something like that. Evidently, and then Erewhon moved from its funky location in the dock area down by the docks to a more contemporary warehouse. It was becoming a much bigger operation. So both production and the shipping and receiving moved from, I think we had like 12 separate locations in buildings down in the docks,
right,
which probably now are, you know, million-dollar condominiums and hip restaurants. That would be my guess as to how they turned out. I haven't been to Boston in years.
Uh-huh.
And I helped coordinate that move, which was pretty extraordinary.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, it was about a $7 million company.
Yes.
And it worked its way up. I don't know if it went to 13 or 17, something like that.
Yeah.
Had a number of stores in various places. One of the alumni of Erewhon, a guy named Tony Harnett, had created a chain of stores called Bread and Circus.
Right.
Hugo had left Boston and gone down to Washington, D.C. and created Yes. So it was an amazing deal. East West Journal was still at that time flourishing.
Yeah.
A gentleman named Sherman Goldman had taken over the editorship.
Yes.
It was a fascinating time and a fascinating place. I met John David Mann there. John was running the Order of the Universe and working always closely with Michio.
Right.
With Michio's writings and Michio's publications. And that was really the time when network marketing surfaced.
Okay.
And it surfaced with people involved with the Cushy Institute, predominantly with a company called Celltech.
Okay.
And although John David really dislikes it intensely when I say that Celltech sold primordial pond scum, it was blue-green algae,
right,
and a number of the leaders and counselors of macrobiotics, John David Mann, Steve Gagné, Richard France, they really latched on to this stuff and
yes,
began to recommend it to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really knew where the coach, which is what we called, a bunch of us called your father the coach.
Right, right.
What did the crazy man's name, Michael... I'm sorry that I don't remember his name, but that was his phrase for his title for Michio, always with great respect, not kidding around.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, but and a bunch of us were the people who would drive your dad out for coffee at 2 a.m. or
right.
You know, and that was although I had the title of being in charge of PR when I lived there, I think I was more one of the two or three people to be depended upon to be able to wake up and take Michio out to a restaurant for coffee, a coffee shop.
Right, right. Yes. Uh-huh.
Anyway, so I worked my way up to the director of marketing after we moved into the new facility.
Uh-huh.
And basically, it wasn't all that. I mean, I kind of created the job for myself, because I had some talents in certain areas. And Erewhon, for me, Fia, was an amazing school and opportunity.
Okay.
In that just because of circumstances at Erewhon, you could find yourself doing stuff where it was really an earn while you learn deal.
Right.
It was just an amazing and a special time all throughout the Boston macrobiotic community, and for all of us as individuals.
Uh-huh.
I would think that everybody I knew would look back, everybody I knew then would look back on those times as just really remarkable.
Yeah.
Because we were a bunch of kids.
Uh-huh.
Jeff Flasher at one point was the oldest person in the company, and he was 33.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's really amazing.
And we were doing, you know, we were really doing a business. We weren't kidding around, but
yeah.
We did it in such a bizarre way. I remember one time sitting around the conference table with all the department heads, and we were talking about budgets and how many hundreds of thousands of dollars for this and for that and for this and for that. You know, millions. We were playing with millions of dollars. And at one point, somebody around the table said, look, I don't mean to embarrass myself or any of you, but I don't, all these numbers, all these zeros don't compute to me. And Flasher said, well, why don't you think of it this way? How many Volkswagens is that? And so we started talking about, well, that's, you know, 37 Volkswagens. That's 180 Volkswagens, you know, and that was how we got through it. Remarkable stuff. Anyway, back to the network marketing connection. That was really my first taste of network marketing. Now, I left Erewhon and went on to work for myself and have done that ever since.
Okay.
And I believe that, to the best of my knowledge, that was in the later 70s.
Uh-huh.
I went out to become a marketing consultant.
Okay.
And then I met a real one,
uh-huh.
And I changed careers from a marketing consultant to a marketing communication consultant.
Okay.
What that meant was I wrote copy. And how I got to be a writer, Thea, is extraordinary. Basically, we had to slash all of our budgets,
uh-huh.
at Erewhon.
Okay.
We had to save hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Okay.
We were not profitable, and it was dangerous. And so the word basically went out to all the department heads, you have to do whatever you have to do to slash your budget, you know. And I did that in my department, in the marketing department, and I became a hero because I think I saved $200,000.
Okay.
And they said, well, how'd you do that? And I said, by doing nothing.
Right.
You know, it's easy if you do nothing. And I said, what you need to understand is that a year from now, you're going to pay the price for this.
Uh-huh.
But I've certainly succeeded and met my goal. Well, in the process of doing that, we couldn't afford a writer for advertising, for label copy, for brochures, and so I started to write.
Right.
And really, that's how I became, quote-unquote, how I became a writer. I was not schooled.
Yes.
I'd taken no courses. I had a love and an affinity for advertising since I was a little kid, because my mom, who I grew up with, came out of Madison Avenue after the Second World War. And so when we would go to New York, which was frequently, we would hang out with her former friends, all of whom were advertising executives and creative advertising people.
Uh-huh.
And they were just so fun and so clever that I just latched on to that. But that I learned to write at Erewhon.
Okay.
And to this day, I did some things back at Erewhon that I'm still proud of.
Uh-huh.
But I left Erewhon, as most of us did. I think Erewhon was more a school. And really, bottom line, that's what your father wanted.
Yes. I've heard that several times from many people.
Yeah, it wasn't a hidden agenda,
right.
on his part.
Mm-hmm.
He would say Erewhon is a school.
Yes.
Now, what he hoped is that people would graduate from his school, Erewhon,
mm-hmm.
or the Cushy Institute or any place else, and go out and continue the work,
yeah.
within a macrobiotic context.
Right.
I certainly, when I left, I stayed within natural and health food.
Yeah.
Throughout my entire journey, and I'm 62 now,
yeah.
I have never left that. Kissed my two older kids goodbye. I like to laugh and say that my two older children, Rachel, who was born in with midwife in very macrobiotic fashion in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Rachel is 29, and my son Johnny, was born down south of Boston, just next to Plymouth in a place called Manomet, also born at home. They were brought up, you know, brown rice and miso soup kids. And even though my daughter came with two different kinds of cheeses and chocolate and other and some prosciutto today, which is not very macrobiotic, one of the things I love about my two older ones is whenever they're sick, they go for miso soup, brown rice. That's what they want.
That's great.
And in fact, this winter, my daughter was in such a bad mess with flu. She called me up in tears and said, "Would you come make miso soup for me?" And I'll tell you, you know, of all of the wonderful things that have happened in my life, and I've been very blessed, getting a call from my my oldest daughter to come and make her miso soup was a joy.
That's great.
You know, and I also have an 8-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old daughter. My joke is I had to make my own grandchildren.
Right.
But I've certainly, you know, I would not call myself by any stretch of the imagination a macrobiotic person.
Right.
It has never left me. I'm married to a Russian. She doesn't get it at all.
Okay.
And, you know, I'd rather be married than at war. So,
right.
However, you know, I very frequently will kind of disappear from the family dinner table and do a week of rice or something like that just to get myself centered and back again. Because I know the truth of it and the power of it, and I've seen how it works.
Yes, yes. Well, let's get on with let's talk about not just network marketing, but I think the subject of entrepreneurship and what it takes, and more even more so on the level of I think you'd be familiar with this, with the level of being on how to be, you know, because I think the work that you're doing or what you've written about certainly is not just applies to network marketing, but applies to which is where we talked about macrobiotic principles, how what you learned in macrobiotics and how you apply that into network marketing, but also in just life in general, like how it's helped you in, or how you might suggest to somebody who, even if they're not interested in network marketing or macrobiotics, just some of these things that you've, lessons you've learned and that you would certainly feel most encouraging for people to do in their lives or be in their life.
Oh, it's such a broad and rich area, Fia. Focusing in on specifics is the hard part.
Right.
certainly, one of the things, there were a number of things that appealed to me about network marketing. Because of my experiences at Erewhon from a marketing point of view, I knew some things to be true.
Yes.
And, you know, you can find the yin and yang behind any of this.
Okay.
The bigger the front, the bigger the back. You know, it really doesn't take much to look at. I am of the belief that all business is spiritual business.
Okay.
And one of the things I learned in macrobiotics, and I don't know that this is a macrobiotic teaching, but it was one that I got, which is that the way you do anything is the way you do everything.
Okay.
And there is no distinction for me between work and life.
Okay.
They're the same thing. The reason I went to work for myself was 9 to 5 made no sense to me. It was great life, macrobiotics. That was the whole deal. And I wanted it to be congruent and contiguous. I didn't want to close the door, close my briefcase, and leave it behind me. I wanted to live it, whatever it was. which is one of the reasons why I went to work for myself.
Okay.
In looking at network marketing, there were qualities that it had that I believed were truly spiritual, truly moral. And I can get esoteric about it. I mean, I can remember looking at the compensation plan structure of normal network marketing and seeing it as a spiral.
Okay.
And realizing that, you know, from the source you went out this level, that level, this level, that level. I mean, one of my favorite things that I've never lost is that your father did a thing called the spiral of manifestation. That's what I remember it being called.
Yes.
And it is from the one, the two primordial, may not be the right word,
right,
but most fundamental tendencies of yin and yang, and from that, the world of vibrations, from the world of vibrations, pre-atomic particles, then atoms, molecules, to the rock-solid reality illusion of same. You know, when we knock on the wood of a chair that you're sitting on or anything like that,
right,
that this is how everything came into being. And I've never forgotten that.
Uh-huh.
And, for instance, today people talk about The Secret. That became a number of years ago just this huge thing where you know, the law of attraction, you get what you vibrate, like is attracted unto itself.
Okay, yes.
That to me was kind of, in all honesty, boring because I'd spent so much time, you know, sitting in front of your father and having him explain how from the world of vibrations, you know, things would come into being, things arrange themselves, and how through your focus, your thought, you know, and the one piece everybody misses, which is the biological component, which we're being forced into today.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think most of the world, especially the United States, is going kicking and screaming, but we're beginning to get that the biological component of all of this is exceedingly real. I'm reading a book called Pandora's Seed, where the gentleman is both an anthropologist and a DNA genome specialist, and he's looking back at the agricultural revolution and how it's evolved and where we've come. And he's got, you know, I'm halfway through the book, and he's already painting a picture of, whether he knows it or not, and I don't think he does, but he's already painting a picture of, you know, brown rice and miso soup, thank you very much, you know, get back to the center of things. Anyhow,
right.
The values of macrobiotics, of justice, and the role that that plays, you know, which came so much from Mr. Osawa, you know, when he would talk about levels of judgment. All of the, you know, I am constantly being reminded by present circumstances and events and how things unfold of the principles I learned from macrobiotics and apply in business. You know, truly, the bigger the front, the bigger the back. One of the ways, for example, that shows up, I do a good amount of work on the internet, have a number of websites and stuff like that, and I have so clearly seen how all of the hype and the hoopla and the bragging and the you know, the flashing of money and this, that, and the other thing to attract people. If that's the front, what's the back? And, you know, and I watch consumers respond now more and more the same way. You know, how they're picking up on, hey, the bigger the front, the bigger the back.
Yes.
The more of that hype and hustle out front, what do you have on the back end of that?
That's right, yes.
And so more and more I'm watching a shift take place. I think one of the reasons for the rise of Facebook and the rise of YouTube is people want real.
Uh-huh.
They don't want slick. They don't want these highly polished presentations.
Yeah.
They're more invested and interested in people being truthful and authentic and honest. And for me, macrobiotics was truthful, authentic, and honest.
Yes.
I don't think we communicated in my day that very well. We
uh-huh.
fell into traps of arrogance and stuff like that. You know, I mean, we kind of felt our way was superior, and you were an idiot if you didn't get it.
Right.
And of course, that'll get you nowhere fast.
Right. Yes. Yes. So can you explain more that you mentioned the spiritual component? What is that spiritual component or gratification that you see that people do get in network marketing when, like you say, there's this flash and this push and this really kind of a slick turn-off, you know, people pushing things in your face and turning people off. But where's the spiritual component that you're talking about? What is that?
Well, again, the bigger the front, the bigger the back.
Uh-huh.
I truly, and I can be accused, Fia, of being a little naive.
Uh-huh.
I know that there are, you know, unfortunately, if you look at the world, and certainly the commercial world, you'll see a lot of crap being very successful.
Yeah.
You know, something that would hit home to people with an interest in macrobiotics is there are a heck of a lot more people making a fortune in the supermarket than
right.
there are, you know, in the natural and health food realm.
Yes.
You know, sad to say, there's a lot of what passes for, quote, natural food, which just ain't. It's to me a bit of a cop out to the large scale refined food production. It's a big job, and people have a tendency. It's very natural, I think, in that sense. People have a tendency to begin to lay economies of scale onto that in order to accomplish their big job. But really, a big job is best done by a lot of small people, you know, small enterprises working together. And that's a structure in network marketing. There's a teacher I learned from in Boston named Robert Fritz who says structure has integrity. And the basic structure of network marketing, for example, people being rewarded for their efforts, directly for their efforts,
okay.
not because of politics or this, that, or the other thing. Really, you've got a job to do. It's to assemble a team. It's to move products. You are rewarded directly for that and really for nothing else.
Uh-huh.
So there's an integrity in that.
Okay.
The same with what I believe is happening in business today. You know, some of the leading marketers, Seth Godin comes to mind. It's
uh-huh.
all about being authentic, Fia.
Yes.
The incredible rise of YouTube, I think, is because people want real.
Right, yes.
They want honest, and they know, I mean, people's, I'm going to use a technical term, I hope I don't offend anybody, but human beings have a bullshit meter.
Yes.
And it's pretty accurate. It's called intuition.
Right.
And, you know, we get hungry, we get greedy, we have our dreams and the things we want, and sometimes we'll err and fall into what looks like a shortcut. But
uh-huh.
the fact of the matter is none of the shortcuts work.
Uh-huh.
You know, the seduction of that is that the shortcuts can make a couple of very visible people and their enterprises very rich very fast.
Uh-huh.
But they don't last.
Uh-huh.
And so all of this natural, organic way of doing things, whether that's running a business or sitting down at the dinner table, you know, or parenting or dealing with the land or anything.
Yes. Uh-huh.
These things today are beginning to assert themselves, forgive me for saying it this way, but like weeds. We can pour concrete over this, that, and the other thing. We can change and arrange and do all this man-made fakaka that we want. But nature pushes through, and I think that's because nature is the truth, and it's the same in business. The truth will out. And so it is the sincere offering at a fair price. It's high service. It's telling the truth. It's having integrity. It's if something's broken, you go fix it. You fix it fast. It's all business being personal.
Uh-huh.
You know, we went through that workshop deal in the 70s where one of the battle cries was, don't take it personally. Well, the heck with that.
Uh-huh.
Take it personally because it is personal.
Yes. Uh-huh.
You know, and I think today more and more, especially entrepreneurs, are wearing their hearts on their sleeves.
Uh-huh.
Telling the truth, and people are gravitating toward them. They're realizing that paying 10 or 15% more
right.
for something that is sincere and is serious and is green, and by green I don't just mean with planetary ecology, I mean personal ecology, spiritual ecology.
Right. Where do you see things evolving in terms of how we do business or network marketing or this telling the truth? Like, where do you see economy, the businesses, you know, things like that, this YouTube and Facebook and all these other things? Where do you see this?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of back and forth that goes on. People always testing. I mentioned shortcuts before. The internet especially is filled with shortcuts. People are selling shortcuts. Probably the most successful marketers on the internet are the guys and gals who will sell you a shortcut on how you can make more money here or do this with your website or get more traffic or yak, yak, yak,
right.
all of that stuff. The deal with a shortcut is no different than any genuine education that's ever been offered since the beginning of education itself with human beings, which is there are people who have gone before you. They've learned from experience. They share their experience. There are wise men and wise women out there, and they're the ones to latch on to, learn from your experience, but they will be the first to tell you there aren't any shortcuts. And the fact of the matter is, in my 60s, I'm doing stuff that I would not, it was simply not possible in my 30s. Now, the people who come after me, could they do it? Should they do it? Will they do it as a possibility in their 50s? Sure, I think that's my job.
Uh-huh.
My job is to say, hey, I'll give you 10 more years of living with some wisdom.
Right.
But we have a tendency, I think, Thea, you know, you're not going to teach a 20-year-old, 50-year-old things to do.
Right.
It takes the time. The natural progression of things must be honored. And I think we're looking for, business is looking for that, I don't know if homeostasis would be a proper term for that, but we're looking for that equilibrium.
Okay.
And so what will happen is stuff will get tried and succeed for a short period of time and then get shot down.
Right.
But what I've found is that the stuff that has integrity, that is authentic, that stuff endures.
Uh-huh.
Those activities endures. Customer service, taking care of people, being grateful for the business that comes your way, making it all about relationships. And I think that, you know, that there's a lesson, blatant lesson from Facebook and a blatant lesson from YouTube and from the marketers who are succeeding most now, especially online, is they're realizing there are no shortcuts to relationship. The connection between human beings is the most important connection.
Yeah.
And anything you do to enhance that, facilitate that, make that easier,
yes,
and give more value. It's all about giving value, giving value, giving value. And it's truly, it's about giving first.
Right.
So you do give first. That action is that way.
Yes.
Well,
regardless of whether you are selling something or not, whether it's whether you're profiting or not, just having a relationship, right?
Well, is it, you know, is it any different? When, I'll go back to something I said earlier, which, you know, pretty much your father taught me.
Yes.
The way you do anything is the way you do everything.
Yes, that's right.
And it is living with integrity.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can't sit there and teach a class on one subject and
yeah.
then go out the back door and blow all that off and live a lifestyle that's in contradiction to that.
Yes. Uh-huh.
You know, it is being congruent. And I really, from an economic point of view, and I am absolutely no expert. My only real great credit is I've probably made more mistakes than I ever thought possible.
Right.
And I haven't learned from all of them. That's for darn sure. I keep repeating those that I need drummed into my head.
Yes.
I think... I had someone tell me the other day, who I have a lot of respect for in terms of the economy, I think we're in for some very, very rude awakening, tough times. Through credit and carelessness, greed,
yeah.
and being irresponsible, and this is not an American problem, no matter to what extent we've led any of these things, you know, that we've been the pioneers of them, unfortunately.
Right.
Basically, what they said is if you look at this quote-unquote financial crisis,
yeah.
and there is a 100% mark, which is it's the financial crisis has reached its full-blown, exploded reality. The truth is we're only at about 35 on that scale of 0 to 100.
Oh, really?
We haven't seen the worst that's yet to come.
Okay.
Going back to network marketing, this is a great thing for network marketing.
Uh-huh.
And the reason it is because network marketing provides the possibility for people
yes.
to make either an extra income, which is becoming required in this day and age,
yes.
to any way for ordinary people. I mean, most any other career, any other pursuit takes, excuse me, my four-legged secretary is mouthing off here,
uh-huh.
Takes education, takes talent, takes experience, all of which takes a great deal of time. Network marketing doesn't have those barriers.
Okay.
You can get involved with network marketing tomorrow, and if you do it right and you've got the mentorship and sponsorship to help you learn what to do and what to say, literally how to do the business, you can be being successful almost immediately. I don't know of any other career possibility like that right now.
Yes.
So I think more and more men and women around the world will be turning to network marketing either as an adjunct to what they're doing now or in place of eventually. I don't recommend that anybody dives in full force to network marketing. I think it needs to begin at its best on a part-time basis.
Yeah.
So that you can do the learn while you earn deal, because that really is the ideal way to do it.
Yes. Let me just remind our callers that if you have any questions or comments, please press 5-star. We're almost out of time here. We didn't have in case you do have any questions, please feel free to do so. Let me ask you again, John, about you've mentioned the secret, and, you know, there were recently in the past few years this whole trend of the law of attraction and positive thinking and all of those things. What's your take on all of that?
Well, the secret was no surprise to me because I think, although I didn't know it at the time, Thea, in my early 20s when I got involved in macrobiotics, it was more for philosophical and spiritual sustenance than it was biological.
Right.
You know, I mean, I kind of did brown rice and miso soup because that came with the deal.
Right.
I didn't know whether, it didn't even matter that I believed that I could lose weight, which I did. And I'm absolutely convinced if I had not gotten into, I mean, when I graduated from high school, I weighed 198 pounds and I'm 5'9 and a half.
Uh-huh.
Today I weigh under 150 and I still have a too much tummy on me. I am convinced that macrobiotics saved my, I'd be dead. I would absolutely be dead. If you looked at my passport picture from when I graduated from college, you'd realize, you know, this, I mean, sanpaku and hugely overweight, you know, I mean, I was on my way dying. That's for damn sure. So I'm eternally grateful for that.
Uh-huh.
But the spiritual, philosophical, cosmological stuff that I learned in macrobiotics and have been pursuing ever since. I mean, it was at Erewhon that I got involved with personal growth and development.
Uh-huh.
And learned all about that and started to get involved in it. And that's been my life's work, Thea, for 30 years now. So when The Secret came along, I was kind of nonplussed by it. I was amazed at its success, gratified to some extent, and not horrified, but certainly like shaking my head a whole lot at the fact that people would kind of, you know, watch The Secret 20 times and wonder why their life didn't change. You know, it wasn't about how many times could you push play on that movie, on that DVD.
Right.
I do, you know, I absolutely believe in the results of the law of attraction. I believe in where you focus your thoughts is what you tend to bring into the world and manifest.
Yeah.
You know, if you're running around negative and worried and worried and worried and worried and worried, you're going to attract more of the same.
Right.
And so all of that I hold pretty true and pretty much as the law.
Right.
How we apply it is unique to every individual. I mean, the older I get, the more flexible I get.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Certainly in my thinking.
Right. Well, we're just about out of time. What words of wisdom would you like to share with us today?
Yeah, I don't have any of those. You know.
Yes.
I don't mean to be difficult or contrary.
No. I understand where you're coming from, which is great.
Well, I hope I've contributed to people. I thought it was a bit of a stretch, you know, me talking about all the wonderful macrobiotic principles. I'm not sure how clear I've been.
Yeah, well, it's. I think this is probably the first call of its kind ever. and I don't know how clear. I mean, we probably could be a lot more clear, just given the subject matter. But I think this has also been an exploration of mine, a departure from the Macrobiotic Miracles calls. But it's really, I think what you've done and applied to network marketing been part of the is part of all of the development and benefit of us in applying macrobiotic principles. I'm just got distracted by this beeping on my phone. But it's the whole picture. It's not just food, but food is important, and it is the principles and understanding, as well as application in all these different fields, that I think is important. And so I am happy that we had this conversation. I'm happy that we have explored other areas in which macrobiotics actually can be applied, which I think we've covered to the best of our abilities at this time. So I really
I think,
do.
Theo, one of the lessons I learned from macrobiotics is we can pick any realm, any domain, intellectual, physical, emotional, spiritual, and we can go directly for that. If we want to change, that change needs to be in all of those areas. And one of the powers of macrobiotics is that it gives you an opening to use the physical world, your biology, to bring about change.
Yeah.
I mean, when I'm going crooked, I know darn well if I eat rice for a couple of days, I'll straighten out.
That's right. Yes.
The problem is, unless people have the experience of that, they don't get it.
Yes.
I think that's always been the challenge with macrobiotics, is you've got to do it to know about it. This is not something you can just grasp conceptually and call it a day.
Yes, right. And that's really the conclusion of my parents, and my father especially, in saying that macrobiotics, he's really... In terms of trying to create peace on Earth, he's really saying that macrobiotics is the first biological revolution. That there were political revolutions and spiritual, religious attempts to create peace on Earth, but this is the first biological revolution that we're trying to undertake. So with that, I just want to thank you again for your participation and for joining us on this fascinating subject and for all of your wonderful words and wisdom. And let me just remind callers that tomorrow evening we are having a wonderful guest who is a musician. Her name is Melody Gardeau. She's a Grammy-nominated multi-platinum album artist. She'll be on. She had a terrible car accident, and she recovered primarily using macrobiotics and musical therapy. That's tomorrow night. Sunday, a week from today, we have our guest Christina Campion, who recovered from anorexia and bulimia. And that's next Sunday. So those are the calls coming up. And again, thanks again, John. Thanks so much for joining us on this Sunday afternoon. I hope you have a wonderful Father's Day. I hope I haven't interrupted your Father's Day too much, but thanks again. Okay, John?
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate you and all the people listening. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. Okay, have a great afternoon. Thank you.